Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great of you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about Jeanne de Clisson, the lioness of Brittany. You may not have heard of this lady, but, well, I say lady, wasn't much of a lady, to be honest, with some of the stuff she got up to, but we're going to have a chat about exactly what happened during her life. She started off as a French noblewoman who, to put it very mildly, got a little bit pissed off with her king, Philip VI, in the 14th century, and ended up becoming a bloodthirsty and brutal pirate, reaving French ships and murdering hundreds and hundreds of people throughout her career as part of the Hundred Years' War. It's a very interesting story to see exactly how she got there and exactly what she did, after becoming this pirate, starting off as a nobleman, ending up as a pirate, going around and murdering blokes. So let's get stuck into it and have a chat about the life of Jeanne de Clisson and figure out exactly what was going on there. So starting things off in 1300, very nice and neat here. She was born in 1300 in the Vendée, which is about halfway down the western coast of modern-day France. She's born to a noble family. She enjoys a pretty comfortable childhood with the old, silver spoon very firmly stuck in the mouth, whatever else. But as was the norm back then, she's married off to another noble fella at the age of, get this, at the age, right, of 12. So at the wedding, she's there bloody, dabbing and doing bottle flips and all that sort of stuff there. But her new husband, again, forced into this marriage with another noble. This is what happened. This is very, very normal back then. People of the upper classes were married off without any sort of say in it by their by their parents or whatever else, by the dynasty they were part of. Anyway, so she's married off to this bloke whose name is Geoffrey. Bit of a pedestrian name. Bit of a unexciting name there for a French nobleman. But anyway, he's 19, so he's robbing the cradle just a little bit here. And we don't know too much about the marriage. There's not too much exciting stuff not exciting for us, because for those two, there's all sorts of exciting stuff. I'm sure they got up to all sorts of exciting stuff because they had two kids. So, obviously they weren't just sitting there twiddling their thumbs. But anyway, these two kids, actually, Geoffrey's family must have had a real thing for unexciting names, because he names the first kid after himself, so Geoffrey Jr., and then the second one, Louise. Now, I don't want to have a crack at anyone called Geoffrey or Louise, but, when you're thinking of 14th century French nobles, you're thinking of people, names like Estienne or Gaspard, not bloody Geoffrey and Louise. They sound like the HR department at the castle. Anyway, all is well with Jeanne and Geoffrey until 1326, when poor old Geoffrey just dies, just like that. No idea why. The history books are very quiet about this guy's death. I don't know if something's been covered up here, but honestly, I couldn't find a single detail about why this bloke actually popped his clogs. Anyway, it looks like Jeanne herself isn't so into the single life, however, because after Geoffrey, again, shuffles off this mortal coil, she gets married again, this time to a guy whose name is Guy de Penthievre. But as it happens, this one doesn't last either, because this marriage ends up getting a papal annulment in 1330. And again, I'm not sure why. This Jeanne, she seems to have shacked up with some pretty shadowy figures in her younger days. But anyway, happily for Jeanne, the third time is in fact the charm, as she settles down with her third, but not final as it turns out, husband later in the same year in 1330. So she's getting through these blokes, but eventually finds one that she likes. This fellow's name is Olivier de Clisson. And as you can probably guess, Jeanne gains her notoriety after having taken his name. She's now Jeanne de Clisson herself. Anyway, quite unusually for the time, I talked before about the fact that, aristocratic or noble marriages at this time were usually political and not made for love. And so oftentimes, generally the bloke got the better deal of it, because he could go and, have mistresses and root kind of whoever he wanted, while, she had to stay at home doing whatever, she was told. So pretty rubbish situation, again, for French, or for noble, not just French noblewomen, but noblewomen at the time generally. But happily for these two, they're smashing paradigms all over the place, because Jeanne and Olivia actually have a very, very happy marriage. By all accounts, they are just absolutely madly in love with each other, loving life and having a great time, right? So they sprog out a couple of kids together. Well, actually five altogether, but most of them die while they're, rather young, which is pretty normal at the time. Again, not a lot of, they're not bloody, washing their hands after they go to the loo and, all sorts of stuff like that. Anyway, you know, apart from the fact that they've sort of, you know, sprogged out a few dud kids, it's fair to say that things are pretty bloody good in the Duclisson household. You know, they're playing Scrabble, having bloody family movie nights, jumping the old Kia people mover and heading down to the beach or whatever. One of the boys named also named Olivia, he becomes Olivia the fifth. He goes on to get the nickname The Butcher. And he becomes the Constable of France. So he's destined for great things, but that's all, of course, a fair way off right now. Because in the early 1340s, right, a conflict arises between local noble families who is going to inherit the Duchy of Brittany. This conflict becomes known as the War of the Breton Succession, and it's a pretty significant part of the beginning stages of the Hundred Years' War, which you've probably heard of, the Hundred Years' War, massive conflict between the French and the English, and also didn't last for 100 years. It lasted for 116 years, so some historians really need to, you know, sort of pull it together and you know, pull their heads out of their asses, because 100 Years' War, very, very misleading title. Anyway, the War of the Breton Succession itself, it lasts for a long time as well, not 116 years, but it goes on for 24 years. It doesn't wrap up until 1365, but that's sort of outside the scope of what we're talking about here today. We don't have time to go through, you know, the whole 100 Years' War and all that sort of stuff, but the War of the Breton Succession, more or less all of these conflicts at the time, part of this, you know, the Hundred Years' War period, again, was between the French and the English. Not going to be a surprise there. Essentially, the scrap was about whether the female heir or the male heir would take the duchy. Now, the French backed the female Blois heir, and the English backed the male Montfort heir. So, as the conflict opens up, Jeanne's husband, Olivier de Clisson, he backs the French heir. Obviously, you know, he's a red-blooded Frenchman. He's going to get behind his king, and he's going to do the right thing by his blokes. And obviously, as a nobleman, he's put into battle, commanding some of the troops for the French army under King Philip the Sixth. When it all comes to guts, so obviously these fight, you know, the war breaks. There's not much of a war if there's not actual fighting. So when that happens, Olivier jumps on his horse, kisses Jeanne goodbye, and says, "I'll be back later. Going to go and kill me some Englishmen." So Olivier, he has a pretty distinguished career. He's involved in the Siege of Vannes in 1342. The English try 4 times to capture the town of Vannes, and after some pretty mixed results, they managed to take it once for all in December 1342. So Olivier, he's fighting his heart out here, but ultimately, once the English king, Edward III, personally decides to oversee the siege, it's successful and Vannes falls. So Vannes, once it falls, Olivier is taken prisoner by the English, and he's dragged back off to England to rot in the dungeon for a bit. Now, Edward III, he doesn't hold on to him too long as a prisoner, however, because, of course, at this time, one of the main reasons that noblemen were captured by opposing forces was to ransom them back to, you know, to the people that they'd been fighting for. And this is exactly what happens here. Edward III, he approaches the French, says, "G'day, mate, how you going? Listen, if you French blokes chuck us back my mate Ralph de Stafford out of your dungeons, and a little bit of cash as well on this side, you know, for a ransom, we'll give you this Olivier fellow back." Now, the French, they can't believe how generous old, you know, English Eddie has been here with Olivier, because he's exchanging Olivier for an absolute pittance. Obviously, the French take the deal straight away. They're not going to leave that one on the table. It's a bloody good deal. But it raises more than a few eyebrows, I can tell you this, because there is some suspicions that sort of Olivier got away with murder here. He should have commanded a much higher price as a noble prisoner, and some vicious rumours start to swirl around the French courts, I'll tell you this. In the court of the French King Philip VI, people are back-chatting about this bloke like you wouldn't believe. They're saying that the reason the ransom was so low is because Olivier was actually a traitor who had conspired with King Edward and had, you know, deliberately lost the siege of Vannes to give away the town. Now, French Phil, he's very ready to believe anything at all that is, you know, bad about English Eddie. He's very ready to believe anything that paints his rival in a negative light. So he starts to put his plan into motion as to how to deal with this. They've sort of got him hook, line, and sinker with this Olivier nonsense here. Anyway, a truce between the French and the English is signed on the 19th of January in 1343, the Truce of Malestroit, just a month or so after Vannes fell to the English. Now, old French Phil, he wants to chuck a party because of this truce, so he invites all of his mates around for this massive big tournament. So these huge, boatloads of lords and nobles, generally knobby blokes of all types, were invited. And so, of course, Olivier is no exception. And so he hops on his horse once again, kisses Jeanne goodbye, and this turns out is for the last time, and rides off to the party. And he gets there, party's bloody going off, you know, black-eyed peas are on, they're popping the champers, partying like it's $12.99 all over again, having a great time. But oh no, what's this? During the big tournament, along come the king's men here on the back of the king's suspicions about his treason. They arrest Olivia and drag him all the way to Paris to be tried. Now, poor old Olivia, he is tried, he is convicted, and he is sentenced to death for treason. And all of this happens at a blistering pace, because on the 2nd of August, 1343, Olivia is taken out of his cell, he is dragged to the marketplace in La Halle, and he had his head cut off. He just straight up like that, no explanation, no public announcement, nothing else like that. He has his head cut off, and then further than that, his decapitated body is hung from a gibbet, or is it a gibbet? A gibbet? I probably should have looked that up before I started, to be honest. I'm going to go with gibbet, but I'm not 100% confident with that one. Anyway, he's on this gibbet while his head was whacked on a spike in Nantes, right? Now, this execution, it created a massive stir. Huge, big controversy, this one. People are very unhappy about it. I'll tell you why. Reason number one. The evidence of this bloke's guilt was never made public. The other noble lords and all the nobs and everything, they never shown why he had been convicted. Reason number two is that all the stuff with the gibbet and putting his head on a spike was generally reserved for, you know, the lower classes, not the nobs themselves. They were above such things usually. And so for these reasons, the execution is very poorly received. It's getting, you know, 1 and 2 star ratings on Yelp, I reckon you could say, by most of the French nobility at the time. But that is nothing compared to how it is received by Armée Jeanne, the now widowed wife of Olivia, when she finds out what happens. Jeanne cannot bloody believe what has happened here. She is devastated, obviously. Obviously, absolutely bloody devo she is, but she's filled with this frothy rage and an overpowering desire for revenge, because this wasn't, you remember, this wasn't the typical political marriage between nobles where you just sort of go, oh yeah, well, whatever. Yeah, I guess he was a good bloke, but whatever, you know, no skin off my nose. Jeanne bloody loved this bloke. Bloody loved him and wasn't ready to pack up and move on just like that. So instead, she packs up her two kids. Obviously, remember, the others have died by this stage, who are called Guillaume and Olivier Jr. He's the bloke who will later go on to be the Constable of France, if you remember. And she takes him off to Nantes. And there, she shows them the decapitated head of their daddy up on a spike there and swears a bloody and brutal revenge on the French King Philip VI. And after having done that, this woman did not muck about at all. She didn't waste a second in getting stuck in with fighting now against the French. This means a complete change of allegiance. You know, assuming you don't believe Philip's assertion that Olivier Sr. was a traitor, because pretty much all of the de Clisson have been fighting against the English on the side of the French for years. But that is all over now. That is all over because of what Jeanne does next. She goes ahead and she sells a bunch of the de Clisson estates, and with the cash that she raises from these sales, she raises this massive army and starts getting stuck into the local French forces like you would not believe. The story goes that she attacked nearby castles and massacred entire divisions of soldiers. Well, actually, not entire divisions, almost entire divisions, because her signature move, her little sort of modus operandi here, the way that she liked to do things, a little post-massacre tradition, I guess you could call it, what she would do after the bloodbath, she would leave one bloke and one bloke only alive so as to go and spread the news of what had happened. So her wrath knows no bounds. She is going up and down Brittany, reaving and killing and even attacking soldiers that were under the previous command of her husband, Olivier, right? So she has completely turned the tables, and every time she does this again, every single time, she is leaving one bloke alive to go and tell the story of this, her butchery and her, her absolute ultimate brutality here. Now, obviously, this can't last. She can't stand against the full might of the French military should King Philip choose to mobilise against her properly. And realising this, obviously, you know, she doesn't want to muck about, and she's a smart lady, and she gets ahead of the, ahead of the field and takes to the high seas at the age of 43, and her famous career as a pirate finally begins after having, you know, reeved up and down the French countryside. She's now going to reeve up and down the French coastline instead. So the way she does this, late in the piece in 1343, Jeanne gets in touch with King Edward of England. She goes over and she says, "G'day there, old mate. Listen, I'll tell you what, you and I, we've got something in common, don't we?" And Eddie looks at her and says, "Oh, yep, okay, well, what's this then? What have I, the King of the English, got in common with you, a French ex-noblewoman?" And she says, I'll tell you what it is, mate. We both bloody hate that miserable bastard, Philip, and we want to absolutely ruin everything he does, everything he touches, good and proper. Is that not true, my friend? And Eddie goes, mate, that is actually, that's a very good point. That is a very, very good point. So what are you thinking? And John goes, well, your match. Listen, check this out. I'm going to kick off a little startup, and it's called Taking to the Seas and Becoming a Bloodthirsty Murdering Pirate. And I'll tell you this, our mission statement, you'll be very excited to hear, is, I'm thinking, right, bugger those bloody French. What do you think about that for a mission statement? And you're in luck, Your Majesty, as well. You're in luck because a unique investment opportunity is in front of you. We just so happen to be looking for capital investment for this venture. So what do you say? And obviously, Eddie's over the moon, chucks a bunch of cash at her. And so with the remaining money from the sales of the de Clisson estates and this new money that the English had, you know, given her as well, she buys 3 warships and outfits them and gets them ready for action, you know, with, again, all of the provisions provided by the English guns and all that sort of stuff. Now, because this woman doesn't muck around in the slightest, the first thing she does is paint all the ships black and dye the sails blood red. She also names her flagship My Vengeance, giving everyone a very good idea of what she's all about here. This is, you know, again, she's not taking any half measures here. She's very much wearing her heart on her sleeve. Now, with this terrifying fleet assembled, she begins to wage a brutal and bloody campaign of murder against French ships along the English Channel. She sails up and down the waters between France and England, mercilessly attacking any and all French ships she sees. This is not just warships. She's attacking merchant vessels and private vessels. If they're French, they are absolutely in the middle of the crosshairs there for her. She secured the undying loyalty of the crews aboard her ships. Obviously, you know, I'm sure that part of it is adulation and part of it is just pants-wetting fear of her as well. Because what they do, they board and capture ship after ship after ship and again, slaughter everyone on... Well, no, not everyone. You know exactly what's coming here. Almost everyone on board, because her calling card was to leave one survivor after these massacres in order to carry news of her onslaught back to the French king, and she does exactly the same thing while on the sea. So as a result of this, Jean's exploits soon become, you know, a fearful legend in the French court and along the coast, and she becomes known as the Lioness of Brittany. And French sailors were genuinely terrified of this woman and her fleet, as you can well imagine. Think about sailing along the English Channel, minding your own business. You know, you've got barrels of frogs and snails and bits of horse and other French delicacies to sell, you know, cheese that you can smell half a mile off. When, oh no, over the horizon, 3 black ships with crimson sails appear and you just know you are buggered. Best case scenario for you there is being the bloke who gets to watch everyone else get slaughtered before becoming a messenger boy. That's the best case scenario for you in that situation. Anyway, aside from the absolute terror that she inspired in the French sailors in the Channel, however, there was also a very practical purpose to her reaving. Whenever she captured a French ship, she would help to supply the English with whatever loot she found. Obviously, the Hundred Years' War is still raging on, don't forget. We haven't passed the 116 years yet. And in fact, Jeanne's assistance is part of the reason for the success of the English at the Battle of Crecy in 1346. She helped to bring in supplies while the battle was raging on, and the English were able to beat a force about twice their size. The Battle of Crecy is actually a super, super fascinating. It's a turning point in the history of warfare, as it's where the English longbow demonstrated its huge superiority. We don't have a huge amount of time to go into it, but I'll give you a quick sort of overview of it here. It's one of the first instances, not only the longbow, but when the Ribaldequin was used, which is a sort of a firearm that looks a bit like a shotgun crossed with a rake. And this enormously powerful English artillery did an absolute number on the French cavalry and provoked a huge change in the way that that battles were fought, because what happened essentially, you could line up all these idiots with bows and firearms in a sort of V formation, and then the French, who refused to get off their horses, were charging this. The French cavalry was charging uphill into this sort of V-shaped disaster zone where they were getting shot off their horses to knights that were at the top of the hill, English knights on foot, who would, you know, obviously cut them down by the end of it. And there are all sorts of disasters that went wrong in the Battle of Crecy for the French and all sorts of things that went right for the English as well. It's a very, very fascinating story. We may come back to it in a future episode, but what I want to focus on now is the fact that Jeanne actually had a material hand in the English victory at Crecy, and again, a turning point in the history of warfare, as it was a radical shift away from the superiority of heavily armoured mounted knights. Anyway, all this is beside the point. Our mate Jean, she continues her campaign of terror long after the Battle of Crecy. So potent is her rage with King Philip of France that she just doesn't let up her violence for years and years. She continues fighting blokes, capturing ships, murdering almost entire crews, and generally just striking fears into the hearts of her enemies for years and years to come. And in 1350, when King Philip dies, she kicks it up another notch, presumably furious that she didn't get to, you know, off the bastard herself. Her retribution is swift and terrible. She now starts to specifically target the ships of French noblemen. When her crew managed to snag a ship with a nobleman on it, Jean would grab her axe and personally cut his head off before tossing the body overboard into the sea, which, by the way, was a huge waste, basically lighting money on fire. Obviously, you know, obviously it's metal as anything here, but she could have made a lot of skrilladilla if instead she'd ransomed these blokes back, you know, back to their families instead of just murdering them. But she didn't care about that, didn't care about that at all. You know, was much more interested in spilling noble French blood than anything else. Anyway, one of the most interesting things about Jean's career of rampant piracy, all this murdering and butchery that she did, was how it ended. Because there's no sufficient explanation as to why she stopped doing what she did. But for some reason, whatever that reason was, in 1356, she just stopped. She, you know, she's getting well on in years. She's been doing it for 13 years. She's into her 50s at this stage. But there's no huge event or you know, any specific moment that prompted her to hang up her bloody sails. She just stopped. She shacked up once again for the fourth and final time, this time with an English bloke named Sir Walter Bentley. And Jean and Walter had a lot in common. They both had personally fought for years against the French and both had, you know, a huge number of notches on their sword belts. And old Walt had been awarded, you know, an enormous amount of land and castles and all that sort of stuff that had been captured from the French. And so he and Jean set up shop in Castle Hennebon near the coast of the English-controlled Brittany. So after 13 years of reaving and pillaging and generally, you know, causing all sorts of mayhem and headaches for the French as the Hundred Years' War continued, she just kind of settled down with this bloke and lived the quiet life. And she died in Hennebon only 3 years later at the age of 59. Now, there's this guy I used to know, and he once told me that happiness is boring. And the fact that the final years of Jean de Clisson seem to have been lived, you know, in more or less complete obscurity suggests that she lived out the final stages of her life in relative contentedness. But, you know, when you sort of look back at her life as a whole, going from 14th century marital bliss to becoming a murderous and bloodthirsty pirate, it's pretty sweet pivot as it is. But then to pivot back to a husband and a white picket fence, well, no, not a white picket fence, a grey stone wall, Jean really didn't do too badly for herself. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Jean de Clisson, the lioness of Brittany. I do realise that I don't think I ever pronounced Jean's name twice in the same way throughout the entire podcast. French, not my strong suit, I have to say, but, you know, you'll have to forgive me. I hope you enjoyed the story all the same. That's just about that. The boring housekeeping stuff to close out the show. Halfasthistory.net is the podcast website. You can find all the previous episodes and links to Twitter page at halfasthistory. No O, wouldn't fit, very annoying. And a Patreon as well, if you want to chuck us a couple of bucks. Obviously, you don't have to, but it is very, very nice. I do appreciate anyone who is supporting the show financially. Still got stickers to give away. If you send us an email, halfasthistory@gmail.com, I'll send you those out for free. Don't even worry about that. And another thing I'm actually interested to know is how you found out about the show. So if you want to send us an email and let me know how you you came across Half-Assed History, you know, I'd really appreciate it. Maybe I might include a couple more things in the envelope I send you as well if you let me know how you came across this podcast. Anyway, that is about that. Going to close things out as usual with a question posed on Reddit, this time by Reddit Historian. This is a very, very good piece. I like this. I like this Reddit username a lot. Okay, Kumpoopa, so a marvellous confluence of Radiohead and toilet humour there. Anyway, OK Kumpoopa wants to know, we've talked about Jean de Clisson as a notorious pirate going around, you know, reaving and pillaging like so many other pirates, and obviously one of the best-known pirates in history is Blackbeard. And OK Kumpoopa wants to know, what kind of stuff did Blackbeard download that made him such a notorious pirate?